And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source of insight and perspective on global warming news. My name's Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of June 14th, 2019. Today, we are pleased to be joined by two proponents of massive changes to address climate change. One is Gary Rozinski, a friend of the show here, has been on before. Gary Rozinski, how are you doing?
Good, Ted. Thanks.
And Gary is the co-leader of the Boston chapter of the Citizens Climate Lobby, and we'll learn more about that in a minute. Our other guest is a new friend of the show, Mr. Rick Herron. How you doing, Rick?
I'm great, Ted. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, good to have you here. So Rick is the co-coordinator of the Sunrise Movement down in Nashville, Tennessee, which is great. The Sunrise Movement has literally taken everything by storm. It's good to have somebody from that organization with us. So the reason these two fine guys are with us tonight is to think about specific policies and how we're going to address climate change. And one of the classic mechanisms for addressing climate change has been to put a price on carbon, right? And that goes under very many different kinds of names. Carbon pricing, though, is the least politically, explosive. Anyway, Gary, you work with an organization called Citizens Climate Lobby, which has been lobbying literally for price on carbon for a specific bill. And I think you just had some days down in Washington, D.C. Tell me, what's the proposal from Citizens Climate Lobby, and what have you been doing down in our nation's capital?
Well, the proposal from Citizens Climate Lobby is to use the free market to motivate people, incentivize businesses and investors to decarbonize the economy, mm-hmm. and to really get a clean energy revolution going in the free market and take advantage of the competitive nature of free markets. The way that we intend to do that is kind of by recognition of, for example, back in 2008 when gas went to $4 a gallon, people and businesses changed their habits. So that we know that when the price of energy goes up, businesses and people are going to look around for ways to avoid those increased costs. So the whole concept of the so-called carbon tax is to really engineer a gradual price rise in the cost of fossil fuels. And so therefore motivate the free market, investors and people to change their habits and to look for renewable energy, efficiency, and conservation alternatives to these rising prices. Citizens Climate Lobby is a grassroots political organization. It started in California, and we've been around now for 10 years. So this was our 10th national conference.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And we have been focused solely on one policy proposal the whole time, and that is what we call a revenue-neutral carbon fee. And the idea here is that you put a gradually increasing price on carbon dioxide, or the emissions of carbon dioxide that will be produced when you burn fossil fuels. You put a price on that. You collect it at the point of origin, the wellhead, the mine, or the port of entry. And by putting that fee on, obviously that fee is going to work its way through the value chain and be reflected in energy price inflation throughout the economy on a very broad base scale. What we propose to do with that fee is to take it and distribute it to households on a per capita basis. So not on a demographic basis, not on any type of, no preference to anybody, whether you are a heavy energy user or a light energy user, or whether you're entirely off the grid, every adult would get the same check, and children would get checks, what we call a half share, for an unlimited number of children in each household.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what we do is, yes, we force this energy price inflation, which is going to jumpstart this clean energy revolution in the free market, and then we give the money back to households. And what happens in that case is that if you're not a heavy energy user, if you don't have a very high carbon footprint, you're going to find that your energy price, the energy inflation that you experience is much less than the check that you get back in the form of the dividend.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll come out ahead. And economic studies across the board have shown that about 60% of households, or between 60 and 70% of households by income, actually break even or come out ahead under this scheme. So obviously, any with no income or who's poor, low, moderate income will be coming out ahead because their carbon footprint is just naturally smaller.
And Gary, just let me interrupt. I mean, one of the things that you, I think then you would say is that sort of the environmental justice component of the existing structures, the way we do things now, the unfairness of the system is sort of how recompensed by giving everyone an equal share back, and the people who have suffered the most long term will, in a sense, make more money because they spend less on carbon to begin with. Right? Is that the idea?
Right. We always say that the people who have done the least to cause the problem are going to be the ones most impacted first.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular, at least with respect to the economics, in this particular case, those who have contributed the least will be getting more back in financial compensation than those who are continuing. You know, I'm probably... I'm sad to say it, but those people like me, right, who, you know, because energy use and carbon intensity correlate so heavily with income,
right,
those at the upper end of the income scale are going to experience more energy price inflation. They're still going to get the same check, but it's going to mean less to them.
So tell me, it's my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, you were down in Washington over the last few days to lobby with Congress people. What was the reception in D.C.?
So we've been going to Washington for 10 years, and we had over 1,500 people who traveled to Washington on their own nickel. We were actually right at the limit of the venue that we're able to go that is able to house us. So next year, I don't know what we're going to do.
And
here's something that, you know, blows my mind. In the past, whenever we've gone to Washington, we've always, in the last few years at least, we've had about 500 meetings, typically 500, 501, 502. There always seem to be these holdouts who were not interested in meeting with us. Well, this year, we had 526 meetings with members of Congress.
Uh-huh.
Now, that means that we were not just nine shy of meeting with every office on the Hill.
Good for you.
And that's because of what Sunrise Movement has done. That's because of what Extinction Rebellion has done. That's because of what Greta Thunberg has done. That's because of what Hurricane Harvey did. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, Hurricane Florence, I think, was another one.
Hurricane Michael.
Yeah. And in general, the wildfires and now the flooding that we see, all of that is kind of coming to a head. And, you know, one of the things I heard from a Democratic office that I visited was that the aides in that office have heard that aides from the other side of the aisle are actually calling out to think tanks and academics and others to find out what the options are for addressing climate change. And as we heard, nobody, you know, when they call a hearing on Capitol Hill about climate change, nobody on the panel is calling climate deniers anymore. Everybody focused on the what the solution should be. So 526 meetings and a very positive response. I only visited Democratic offices, but very positive responses. And we do have a bill. It's a bipartisan bill. It had one Republican co-sponsor going in the House of Representatives. It's mm-hmm. called the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act.
Mm-hmm.
And it's H.R. 763. And we were there trying to drum up more co-sponsors. And as I say, you know, with 526 meetings, meeting virtually every office and having you know, these relationships that go back years now
with doctors.
We don't go in and just tell them who we are. We're not introducing ourselves for the first time. We're having substantive discussions and answering questions about the policy, economic, and social impact of this legislation.
Well, that's great to hear. And I should tell our listeners that we've tried to set up a little bit of a symmetric circumstance here because Rick from Nashville will be given a chance to talk about the Green New Deal, which is, I see, sort of a counterpoint to the carbon pricing. But so, Gary, you can jump in if you want, but I'm sorry, Rick, you can jump in. But Gary, let me ask you. I mean, you said it's interesting that you talked about free market, the free market forces, right, as being the engine underneath the carbon tax that will bring us improvements, right? And that's a very appealing idea that people's self-interest, when they see the price of carbon going up, will act sort of. Who's the guy who wrote the Invisible Hand of the Market, right? I mean, Adam Smith, right? This is all going to, this is like built into the nature of the world. But do you think that tell me this, do you think that a carbon tax is, carbon tax is the wrong word, carbon fee, is that an adequate response? Or is that a first step? Or where do you see the carbon tax fitting in? And do you, if you don't think that it's the only thing that is needed, if later in some circumstance we're going to violate the free market by spending money, right, and having an industrial policy to build wind turbines, how does that all fit together? I mean, have you guys thought through those options? You must have. You've been at it 10 years.
Well, from the standpoint of Citizens Climate Lobby, the organization is laser focused on this one policy.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying not to muddy the waters in any sense. And put any daylight between, just the focus on passing this bill and what our volunteers are working on.
Right, right.
So we do believe, you know, when you're in a hole, the first thing you should do is stop digging. And so we've got a problem with atmospheric carbon dioxide concentrations, and the first thing we should do is stop adding to that problem. But very soon thereafter, once we get this bill passed,
mm-hmm.
very soon thereafter, we're going to have to turn our attention to taking care of the stock problem, right? Which is that we're at 415 parts per million, and we've got to bring that back down to near pre-industrial levels if we have any hope of stabilizing sea level anytime soon.
Are you proposing geoengineering when you say bring down the stock?
Gary. I'm going off message here now with respect to Citizens Climate Lobby.
Right,
I don't
want
to commit them to anything, and I don't want anybody to think that I'm speaking for them when it comes to anything beyond the price on carbon.
Got it.
Okay.
Got it. We'll make that very clear, right? Beyond that, the carbon, living to the carbon tax, you're speaking for yourself, which is absolutely fair.
And so I recently ran for Congress, and when I ran for Congress, I said there were really just three things we needed to do to fix the climate problem, and that is we have to put a gradually rising price on carbon and return 100% of proceeds to households on a per capita basis. Second thing I said was we need to use rangeland management and agricultural practices to sequester carbon in soils.
Mm-hmm.
Because I believe that there's a huge potential for bringing back semi-arid lands that we think of as desert today, whereas if we were properly grazing them, we would see those turn into grasslands, and grasslands are huge carbon sinks, as well as being able to retain water, bring back local microclimate to something more reasonable, be more resilient, and so on.
Right.
The third thing that I personally believe we need to be doing right now is we do need to be doing research into geoengineering, because we don't know where we stand,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
We know what's going to happen 5 years from now or 10 years from now. And I deliberately say do the research into geoengineering. I don't want to see us do development without very considered conversation or dialogue about that. But I think that those three things will best position us to really, civilization, to manage the risks associated with our current atmospheric carbon concentrations and ocean acidification problems.
Interesting. Well, that takes me even far afield from my own discussion. Let me look over at Rick for a minute. Rick, I think you may be coming from a different perspective. What question would you offer on, let's talk about the free market and a carbon price as the value of that as a method for moving ahead with carbon climate change stuff?
Definitely. Thanks, Ted. I did want to say on the front end, a similar disclaimer. Everything that I say tonight, on behalf of Rick, it's not on behalf of my chapter, Sunrise Movement, or the National Sunrise Movement. So just have to say that up front. I also wanted to say thank you to both you and to Gary for all y'all's work. I mentioned before we started, I got my start in New England in the climate movement and have long for, almost a decade now, have really admired all the exciting stuff that's happening in Massachusetts on climate. Y'all for being leaders in probably one or two most exciting states in the country right now on climate activism and climate policy. And Gary, thank you so much for putting yourself out there running. I have some inkling of what a blessing and what an incredible challenge that is. So I would say, I think Gary and I may be generally on the same page, is that carbon pricing and the Green New Deal can be two great tastes that taste great together. We have different focuses, but I'm really excited. This is the first time I've really gotten the chance or seen anything about, let's debate the relative strengths and merits of the two approaches. So I'm really, I think we're generally on the same page on them being two great tastes that taste great together, but I think it's really important to really dig into the relative merits. I guess, Gary, one thing I would genuinely love to hear about is the response from Republican legislators. If you have a sense from how all those meetings went this time, I don't know if you happen to meet with any. I know y'all said y'all have one co-sponsor right now. So I grew up in Tennessee politics, which is a little different from Massachusetts politics, to put it mildly. But I think, calling a spade, we've had so much asymmetric polarization in this country over the last 10 or 20 years. And especially on climate, but just in general, the Republican Party has been captured by this post-truth circus. Everything from Donald Trump and his forces to the fossil fuel denial machine. Mm-hmm. And that's, the party is still largely enthralled to that. And so in a sane world, internalizing the externality of climate damages, which is exactly what a carbon tax does, would be considered a free market solution. Even by conservatives. And yet there are so many in the party now that somehow don't see it that way. So I would, I would love to hear about kind of how the meetings went and what do you think the best approach is to really remind Republicans that this is actually a free market solution, that internalizing the externality is actually a free market solution.
So fortunately or unfortunately, I was not in any meetings with from across the aisle. I don't know what people experienced in those meetings with Republicans. Sure. If my experience in meeting with my Democratic representatives was any kind of measure, I can tell you that meeting with them year after year for the last 10 years has really established very close and productive working relationships with all of the offices that we've been meeting with. And, it's not just when other CCL members go in and talk with Republican offices, they are going in with messages very much tailored to the values of Republican office holders. So we even have what we call a Republican caucus or a conservative caucus within Citizens Climate Lobby. These are volunteers who lean more conservative, but who are very concerned about the climate. And so they come to us and they work on issues like, the national security threats of climate change or the international economic competitiveness of the United States vis-a-vis other countries. And they'll talk with them. They'll talk with Republicans about those kinds of issues, which they tend to be more motivated by. You know, again, immediately before our conference, I believe it was last Thursday, a week ago today, there was a little news snippet that Mitt Romney, Senator Mitt Romney from Utah, was actually looking at the companion bill that would be introduced in the Senate. Talking with Senator Chris Coons from Maryland or Delaware, I believe, who would be the lead Democratic sponsor on the bill. So, you know, I think that that was just a trial balloon on Senator Romney's part. But I do know that there's a lot of activism happening in Utah as well around the issue. And so he probably is feeling some pressure to look for solutions. So
that's exciting.
Go ahead.
Admired about PL is the great lobbying training y'all do and the emphasis on finding the right messengers with the right message. So I feel like if there is a solution, it's got to be folks like CCL who are from the grassroots talking to folks in their communities about this, you know, conservative folks talking to conservatives. And, you know, we need to talk to everybody, but especially folks hearing from messengers in their own community, mm-hmm. whether those are hunters and anglers or faith-based messengers or, you know, folks who were already in the Republican Party, talking to other Republicans who were to overcome skepticism. So I think CCL does such a great job of that. So I just wanted to say that.
So but let me do this. I'm going to channel Chris Matthews from Hardball for a little while and put you guys both on the spot. All right, here. I come back to you. I'm showing my the pink stripe on my back, I guess. You talk about you obviously have faith in the free market as the, as I said, the engine by which the carbon tax is going to work. There are people out there who say that capitalism is in fact the enemy of climate success. That capitalism as embodied in free markets is the problem, right? And that to solve the problem of climate change, we need to find a way around the markets, neuter capitalism as it is known now. And I mean, that leads to the sort of socialism charges you hear tossed around. Let me just put you on the spot. I mean, yes or no, as I say, I'm channeling my Chris Matthews on TV. Yes or no, is capitalism the enemy or the friend of climate action?
I think that well-regulated capitalism is definitely the friend of climate action. Okay. I can't think of any better approach to discovering what the thousands upon thousands of solutions are that we're going to need to fight, you know, to bring down emissions, mm-hmm. than to motivate people's competitive and frankly, this is, I find a better word for this, but greed.
Yeah, yeah.
We're just interested in making as much money as they possibly can, while doing it to, you know, to the betterment of society and to helping to begin healing the world. You know, I've been in the free market. Well, I've been in the free market or the public sector for the last 35 years in the software industry. In that time, I happened to do one startup at one time. And, you know, we were not bad people. We were just, we looked out and we saw what we thought was a need in the market. And we put our minds towards developing a product that would meet that need.
I was in a startup too. Anyway, let me put Rick on the spot. Rick, is capitalism, this is just, again, sort of short answer. Is capitalism the friend or the foe of climate action?
Yes, it is the friend or the foe of climate action. I will say, yeah, I mean, I agree that clearly the laissez-faire capitalism that we have where, you know, corporations are buying politicians and lobbyists by the scores and capturing regulators and not considering at all their pollution or their, you know, the effects that their businesses have on real people in the real world, that obviously is madness. And, you know, that's why in the, you know, 50 years ago, Republican President Richard Nixon established the EPA because people realized that unfettered capitalism was destroying our environment. I think there's a whole giant spectrum. I'm not copping out. This is my honest answer. There's a gigantic spectrum between capitalism and socialism, and there's no binary state, right, is my answer. You know, we're going to have some kind of a mixed economy, but I think the real thing is that there was a local politician, Annabelle Clement O'Brien, from my home state of Tennessee, and she used to open up her stump speech with the line, "Politics is a beautiful word to me." And she'd say that, and she'd watch the confusion wash over everyone's faces, and she'd say, "Politics is how our children are educated, and people receive care, and our roads are built, and all these, you know, so basically, you know, how all these wonderful things happen."
Right.
And so I think, you know, to do carbon pricing or a Green New Deal, we have to, the political common sense in our society has been that laissez-faire capitalism is great and government is the enemy, is bad. And what we need to do is we need to move to political common sense where robust government action for the common good is what we need. And so I think that's my answer, is that we have to, you know, and I think, you know, I think there are things that other externalities or other things that the market does not do well at all that the government has to step in and do. You know, there's more patient R&D capital, or types of R&D that the private sector doesn't want to do or doesn't want to do at the scale we need. There's public transit, you know, all the externalities and negative and positive, and all the urban planning that goes into that, all the investment.
Well, you'd be happy to know that here in Boston, we had the Red Line train derailed twice in 2 days. So there's a complete standstill in transit here in Boston. Well, look, I want to thank you both for giving much, much more detail than my one-word answer request to both of you, but you were both very clear in your answer. This is a very interesting discussion. I want to thank you both for taking the time to chat. We will continue this. Maybe we'll reverse roles and have another discussion about the way the Green New Deal will work. But what we'll do is we'll put up links to some of what we talked about at the blog. It's massclimateaction.org/blog. You can find this podcast on our Facebook page at /massclimateaction. Please share us around. Of course, you can send us an email if you have an opinion about whether or not capitalism is a friend or foe of climate action. Please send it to podcast@massclimateaction.net. That's the email. Let us know what you think. You can listen to the show directly on your smartphone using Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Overcast, Podbean, yada, yada, yada. And lately, we are now on Spotify. You'll be happy to know. I want to continue to thank D.R. Tucker for all of his research support. Mariah Tinger will be back with us next week. So we'll close where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulations, investment, and Gary, I want you to know, it says price on carbon to safeguard our collective future. So thanks to you both for being here.
Thank you, Ted.
And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.